Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's program, Disparities in COVID-19 Data. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question and answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touchtone phone. You may withdraw yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. Please note this call may be recorded, and I'll be standing by if you should need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Sue Dorfman. Please go ahead.
Hi, welcome everyone to our conference call today, Racial Disparities in COVID-19. Again, my name is Sue Dorfman. I will be your moderator for today. The first person you are going to be hearing from is going to be Kristen Clark. She is the president and executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. The Lawyers Committee is one of the nation's most important national civil rights organization in the pursuit of equal justice for all. And Kristen, go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Kristen Clark, president and executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. We are taking action today alongside hundreds of doctors and medical professionals. We're issuing a letter demanding that the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services and its sub-agencies immediately begin releasing daily racial and ethnic demographic data related to COVID-19 testing. We believe that this data is critical in the fight against this pandemic. The public deserves transparency in order to fully understand the impact of this pandemic and its disproportionate effect on certain African American communities. We are sounding an alarm in the wake of reports from doctors on the front lines and some data which suggests that this pandemic is indeed having a starker impact on African Americans. We need the CDC to begin publicly reporting racial and ethnic demographic data. We need this data with respect to COVID-19 cases, tests performed, and fatalities. We know that the CDC is in possession of this data based on information that is currently required by the COVID-19 case report form. We know that Black Americans are particularly vulnerable based on decades of systemic discrimination and bias, and the fact that African Americans suffer from a higher rate of pre-existing conditions, African Americans are particularly vulnerable at this moment. African American communities are without the privilege of being able to stay at home. Only 20% of Black workers in the country are able to work from home compared to roughly one-third of their white counterparts. African American communities face a higher degree of risk exposure. Private COVID-19 testing is cost prohibitive, making it very difficult for low-income communities and particularly people of color to get tested. Title VI of the Civil Rights Act and Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act are clear. These civil rights laws prohibit federally funded healthcare providers from administering services in a discriminatory manner. In addition, we are calling today on public health departments across the country to do the same, to begin reporting data along lines of race now. The state of Illinois is instructive. This is one state whose Department of Public Health is indeed making data available along lines of race. As of 11 a.m. today, 29.4% of confirmed cases in the state are among African Americans. African Americans comprise 41.2% of COVID-related deaths. Yet African Americans make up only 14.6% of the state's population. States are reporting data along lines of geography, gender, and age. There is no defensible reason for excluding racial demographic data. Our ability to fully understand and confront this pandemic requires and demands that we obtain racial data now in this fight. We'll now turn the floor over to our next speaker, Dr. Uche Blackstock.
Good morning. I'm Dr. Uche Blackstock. I am the founder and CEO of Advancing Health Equity. I'm also a practicing emergency physician in Brooklyn, New York. So I have been working on the front lines of this pandemic for the last few weeks. I have seen in my waiting rooms and in my exam rooms, mostly Black and Brown patients who are essential workers and service workers who cannot afford to stay home. These are the ones that I see presenting to the clinic with COVID-19 symptoms. One of the concerns is the lack of widespread testing that is accessible to these patients. These patients also, as noted earlier, tend to have a high chronic disease burden, specifically diabetes, asthma, and hypertension, which put them at higher risk for developing serious complications through COVID-19. And we already know that our healthcare system is embedded with bias. We have data already that Black patients are likely to receive worse care from the minority-serving hospitals in their areas that are ill-equipped for dealing with COVID-19 patients. The importance in being able to collect racial and ethnic demographic data in this pandemic is that we will be able to see which groups are going to be most harshly affected, and we already have preliminary data on that. But we need to know in order to allocate healthcare resources most equitably. So we call on HHS to mandate the collection of racial and demographic data so that we can actually see the impact on our most vulnerable communities. Thank you.
Thank you. We're now going to turn the call over to Dr. Tyson Bell, an assistant professor of medicine.
Hello, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Tyson Bell. I'm a pulmonary critical care and infectious disease physician at the University of Virginia, and I've been involved in the COVID response. I work in the ICU in our COVID unit. I'm the medical director of the medical intensive care unit, and I see COVID patients or suspect COVID case patients in a clinic that we've set up, which I'm going to do in about an hour, actually. And I'm really glad that and you all invited me to this call, because I think this is very important. The world will not be the same after this virus is done infecting a vast proportion of patients. And it's exposed a lot of weaknesses in our healthcare system. But most upsetting to me is that we continue to allow disparities to dictate care and the outcomes of people based on where they live, what color skin they have, their walk of life. Early and aggressive testing has been a failure, and I'm not happy about that. Early and aggressive testing allows us to safely quarantine patients who have symptoms and test positive so that we can prevent the spread of the virus. Early and aggressive testing helps hospitals and healthcare systems project what surge capacity they need and what resources they may need so that they can have a sense of what's going on in their community. They need that information for their modeling so that they can anticipate what surge capacity they may need. This is a virus that has an anticipated clinical course where we can project when we think our maximum surge of patients will come into our healthcare system. But if we don't have that information, it means absolutely nothing. But most importantly, early and aggressive testing allows to keep us all safe, our whole country. This virus is 10 times more deadly than influenza, and it spreads at least 2 or 3 times more easily than influenza. So how we treat our most vulnerable populations reflects poorly on us if we're not taking care of them, and it also makes the whole country at risk for contracting disease. And we see cases like in Michigan, where African Americans make up 14% of the population, 35% of the active cases. We see in states that aren't reporting on racial demographics that there's been a surge in patients dying from respiratory distress and hypoxic respiratory failure and acute respiratory distress syndrome. These are diseases that COVID causes, but they're not diagnosed as COVID because they're unknown and weren't tested. This is absolutely unacceptable. And my job is to work in an intensive care unit. It's my job to remain calm, and I'm upset about this. I'm upset because it's affecting my community. It's affecting the health of our world. And this virus has made itself clear that It does not care about race, ethnicity, your walk of life, where you come from, certainly not geography. So why in the world would we respond by continuing to allow racial equities in inadequate care, unequal care? Why would we let that continue? This is an instance where we need to rise to the occasion. We need to take care of our community, and it absolutely starts by knowing where the problems are. Thank you.
Thank you. And our final speaker, our final speaker today will be Darielle Rodriguez. She is the director of the Economic Justice Program at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, where she leads the committee's efforts to combat discrimination, employment, health care, and on behalf of the communities of color. Go ahead, Darielle.
Thank you. The Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law is incredibly proud to partner with more than 350 medical professionals in this call to action to the federal government and to state health departments across the country. Access to health care is a critical civil right, and it is a social and economic and racial justice issue. How one community is treated impacts all communities across the country, and our most vulnerable populations need to have equal access to testing and to healthcare. We will continue to call on the federal government and state and local departments to increase transparency and to shed light on how communities of color are being impacted during this pandemic. Thank you.
Thank you very much, everybody. And again, just to recall the list of speakers, Kristen Clark, the President and Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, Dr. Urche Blackstone, founder and CEO of Advancing Health Equity and a board certified emergency medical physician, Dr. Tyson Bell, an assistant professor of medicine, and Darielle Rodriguez of the Lawyers Committee. The line is now open for question, and I'm going to ask Nikki, who is our Conference Watch Pro host, to be able to describe how to ask questions. Nikki?
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touchtone phone. You may withdraw yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. Once again, to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touchtone phone. And one moment while we queue.
Okay, well, our first call today is going to be, first question for today is going to be from Brad Brooks from Reuters.
Hey, good afternoon, good morning. Thank you guys for having this call. I've been pushing officials in Louisiana, at the CDC, and other states on to get this data that you all are trying to get out in the public. And what I keep getting back from spokespeople at hospitals and whatnot, at the state levels and at the federal levels, that they're just getting really inconsistent data. They're overwhelmed. They don't have, they just have excuses, these types of excuses. What are you guys yourselves hearing in terms of why this data is not being reported? And do you think it's valid, what you are hearing from folks as to why you're not getting it? And then finally, is that COVID questionnaire publicly available that you mentioned where hospitals or states are required to include data on race and ethnicity?
Yes, I'll take the last question and then turn the floor over to other panelists. The COVID-19 case report form is indeed publicly available on the CDC's website. We'll be issuing a press release following this press call that includes a link to that publicly available form.
Okay.
I can talk a little bit to the testing issue and some of the concerns voiced by agencies. There have been barriers to implementing testing, and I'm sure you guys at Reuters and other agencies know well about that. Some limitations have been at the federal level and the fact that we didn't use the test that was validated and used by the WHO. Regardless, what UVA did was stand up in-house testing. So So the advantage there is that you can do a test for a patient who comes into your facility. The test itself only takes a few hours to run. So instead of sending it out to another facility and waiting for it to come back, you can do it in-house with a quicker turnaround time, and you can actually scale that up if you bring on the right platforms. So UVA was able to do that, and we've taken over a lot of testing for the state because they did have some capacity constraints there. And we've also started to test other hospitals' samples, so they send them to us so we can get it back quicker than it would go to a state lab or to one of the private labs. Nearly every state has a major academic medical center that has the capability to do this. And if there is at least a marginal research effort, you have the ability to get the exact same thing set up in one or several of your academic medical centers. And once you're able to do that, you should be able to scale up and take care of the needs for at the very least your state. I think that the fact that there have been hurdles, that is not an excuse. There are barriers, but that just means they have to be overcome, and you can use the example of other places I've done to overcome those barriers. So I do recognize that there have been challenges. They're just not excuses and explanation that we should accept for this.
Yeah, I would also like to echo those sentiments that, you know, we know that widespread testing would have been the ideal and would have been helpful for the organization.
Hello?
I work, we have contracted with private companies to do testing for our patients, but they are incredibly overwhelmed and have a backlog of about 10 days. So at the point we're at now, I'm in New York City, we are telling patients, you know, to stay at home if they have mild illness and if they have moderate symptoms to come in. But I just think this speaks to just how broken our system is. And the same speaks for, you know, why we don't have the data. We actually have the data. In New York City, we have a regional health information exchange, and all of the electronic medical record systems collect racial and ethnic demographic data. So we have the data, but it's a matter of pressing our departments of health to disclose what that data shows.
Thank you all. Our next questioner is going to be Ronnie Raven from the New York Times.
Hi, thank you. Can you hear me? Hello?
Yes.
I can hear you.
Hi.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. I'm sorry, I came in a little bit late. You did mention some states that do have this data. I think you mentioned Illinois and Michigan that have disclosed this data. Can you review those figures and why those states have some figures?
Actually, all of the states have the data. I mean, it's mandated that this data is collected, that racial and ethnic demographic data is collected. It's just a matter of whether or not the states will disclose the data, and that's the issue that we're coming up against.
But have those two states disclosed data? You did cite some specific figures from Illinois. Is that the only state that's disclosing now?
Yeah.
Or?
There are a handful of other states. I will ask my co-panelists to jump in, but we understand that Michigan and North Carolina are two other states that make some degree of data available. There may be one or two others, but this is a crisis issue across the country. In large part, states are failing to make publicly available and transparent racial and ethnic demographic data.
Right, and we also know that there are some cities, so we know that Milwaukee has disclosed that data, and there are some parts of North Carolina that are also disclosing that data, but it's not being done statewide.
Do you have access to all of that right now?
I have links for, this is Uche Blackstock, I have links for a few of those counties and states, but I don't have it available in front of me right now.
Okay, great. So I'd like to talk to you further then, if we can.
Next up is Aaron Morrison from Associated Press.
Paul, can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
What can you suggest for Black public health advocates, Black and white public health advocates and medical workers who you know, are trying to get the appropriate messaging out there around why this is important for the African-American community. And then also, my second question would be, are there models or methods for collecting this data that exist outside of federal and state governments and their agencies?
I'll turn to our doctors.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you repeat the question? It's a two-part question, right?
Question. The first is, what can Black public health advocates or public health advocates in general do to expand and get the appropriate messaging out there for Black communities around the risk of COVID-19? And then also, are there models and methods for collecting this racial data that exists outside of the federal government and state governments?
So, you know, I think that, you know, sort of calls like this, I personally have been speaking on various platforms, as well as some of my colleagues on this call, about the importance of bringing attention to this issue. As we alluded to before, you know, there are significant and profound pre-existing racial health inequities that already exist. And, you know, despite technological advances over the last 50 years in healthcare, we still have, you know, our Black populations have, you know, the worst maternal mortality rates, the highest chronic disease burdens. And so, you know, this pandemic is basically, you know, we're saying it's a crisis within a crisis. And so we have already incredibly vulnerable populations who communities are going to be absolutely devastated. And so it really should be everyone's obligation, right? So if our most vulnerable communities are not are going to be detrimentally affected by this pandemic, it's really going to affect everybody, all of our society.
Thank you. Next up is Hazel Edney from the Trice Edney Newswire.
Yes, hello. I am sorry, I came on a little late, and so I want to make sure that I'm clear. Your release appeared to say that there are disparities. And so what I would like to know is, where are you finding the disparities? Are they in the localities? And what localities are they where the disparities are showing up the most? And I know that you don't have all the data. That's part of the issue that we in the Black press have been dealing with for a long time. But also, in addition to where you might be finding the disparities in the localities, are these disparities in deaths? Or in testing, where are you finding the disparities? And also, is this call recorded so that I can get the first few minutes?
This is Kristen Clark, President and Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. The call is being recorded today, and we will make that available to reporters who may have joined late. I just want to come back to that prior question and note that data, as far as the messaging for Black health advocates, but data and frontline reports from medical professionals suggest that African Americans indeed face a higher risk in this crisis. Vigilance is required. We need to make sure that we press and demand for equitable access to testing and care, and we need to sound an alarm when African Americans are excluded and left out. To come back to your question, Ms. Edney, some of the reports I indicated that the Illinois Department of Public Health's own data publicly available now, this is a state that we will credit for making indeed some data available along lines of race, shows that African Americans make up 41.2% of fatalities. African Americans make up 29.4% of confirmed cases. African Americans are only 14.6% of the state's population. We also note that the ProPublica reported on April 3rd that in Milwaukee County, where the population is 26% Black, African Americans currently comprise about half of the county's 941 cases and 81% of its 27% deaths. In Michigan, the state's population is 14% Black, but African Americans currently make up 34% of cases and 40% of deaths.
And in North Carolina, the state's population is 22% Black, but African Americans make up 36% of cases and 25% of fatalities tied to COVID-19. This data is not broad and comprehensive, but most certainly suggests that this pandemic is one that's having a starker impact on African Americans, which is why we are demanding calling for transparency now, and calling for the federal government and state public health departments all across the country to do their part in bringing this data to light so that we can effectively tackle the crisis that we're up against.
Thank you.
Next up is Erin Einhorn from NBC News.
Hi, thanks for holding this event. Can you talk about what laws currently exist around what states are supposed to be reporting? I was under the impression that that the law required them to release it. So if not, are they breaking the law? What are the consequences? And also, do you think there's a reason that they're not putting out? I mean, I know you can't prescribe motives to them, but do you care to speculate?
This is Kristen Clark. Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act are among our nation's most important anti-discrimination statutes in this context. Title VI bars healthcare providers from using federal funds to administer healthcare services in a discriminatory manner. And Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act prohibits discrimination on the basis of race and other grounds. We believe that this legal framework requires that the federal government now do its part to publicly make available any race data that it may have. We understand that this data is being collected and not being reported out to the public. And we believe that they need to do their part in pressing state public health departments to do the same, to make this data available, to help shape an equitable response to the pandemic.
Do you know if there was a, do you think that there's a reason that they're not putting it out? And but also my question about the law was specifically, what does the law say of reporting? I mean, beyond obviously discrimination is an issue, but, you know, does the law require states to report this, racial specific data?
So the law requires that if you receive federal funding, that you can't discriminate. So if you're a federally funded school, a federally funded police department, and here we're talking about federally funded hospitals and healthcare providers, you can't discriminate in the way that you provide services. I'm going to ask my colleague, Darielle Rodriguez, to also jump in.
Thank you, Kristen. I think one thing that's important to note is that in the past, the CDC, and ProPublica noted this in a recent article, that in the past, CDC has tracked this type of data, demographic, race, and ethnicity data for other virulent outbreaks, and that they've typically released this level of detail in terms or along lines of race and ethnicity in the past, but they're not doing so for COVID-19. And health entities do have obligations to track this information, and many health entities throughout the state have started reporting on other demographic areas. For example, a lot of states are reporting on cases and case outcomes with respect to gender and with respect to age. But for some reason, they are not reporting along lines of race and ethnicity. So there is a past history of the CDC tracking and releasing that type of information. They're not doing so now. And a lot of other states are reporting and releasing information for other demographic categories, but not for race or ethnicity.
Thank you very much. I also want to say thank you to all the journalists who have raised questions. There is a long line of journalists asking questions, and so I appreciate your patience. The next up is going to be Laura Baron Lopez from Politico.
Hi, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Two questions. The first one, I didn't, for either Ushe or Tyson, I'm not sure who mentioned that the collection of this data is mandated, because one of the states that I spoke to said that race and ethnicity is typically not a data set we collect for infectious diseases, which kind of stunned me. So I wanted to get a response to that.
This is Tyson Bell. That absolutely stuns me too. There's absolutely no reason why we shouldn't be collecting data on race and outcomes, because we know that it's correlated with worse outcomes in certain communities, especially vulnerable communities. I think what's important to remember here is that these institutions are institutions that represent us. Our leaders get our power from the public, and they are accountable to us. And accountability ultimately requires transparency. You need to be held accountable, and you need to show what you know so that people can affordably judge you. So in the question of, you know, are you collecting this data? Why aren't you releasing it? I think because this virus is moving so rapidly and cases are happening every second, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I can explore the why it's not being released later, but it needs to be collected now and released now. So if you're an institution and you have it and you're not releasing it, you need to release it now, because you need to be ultimately accountable to the public. If you, for some reason, like inconceivable reason, that you don't think that it's important to collect racial data on your testing and outcomes, then you need to be collecting that now. And if you don't have the ability, you need to get the ability to do that. I think it's time to really hold people's feet to the fire to make this happen. And we don't have time to really go into why. At least now we can explore that later, but we need to make this happen. And if it's not happening at the appropriate levels, it needs to happen now.
Thank you. And then my second question was, Ushe, you mentioned earlier that, you know, the significance of getting preliminary data now on who is being tested when it comes to African Americans and other minorities is that it helps with directing healthcare resources. Could you explain more what kind of healthcare resources you're talking about and why that's important?
Just in terms of the government's response to which communities are going to need more resources than others, right? So we know that there are certain communities that we already mentioned that are more vulnerable, most likely Black communities and populations. And so we want to make sure that, you know, their hospitals, do we need to redirect healthcare workers? Do we need to redirect, you know, personal protective equipment or ventilators to certain hospitals versus others based on the needs of that community? And so this data can really help us direct those resources to the communities that need them most.
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
I can add a little bit to that because the math modeling that we do and epidemiologists do is based on the number of cases. We have from prior experience in Wuhan, Italy, and on the West Coast and others that a certain percentage of people who get affected with coronavirus will go to the hospital. A certain percentage of those will end up needing ICU care. So if you have an accurate snapshot of the cases in your community and the rate of rise and how many cases are coming in day by day, then you can make a more accurate forecast as to when you think your peak is going to be, and you can adjust your staffing appropriately for that peak. Everything about this is dynamic. Your staffing is dynamic because your healthcare workers are getting sick from this and have to go out. Your bed availability is becoming very fluid. The ICU bed capability is becoming fluid as well, too. So if you don't know in your community how many cases you have and what rate of rise they're achieving, then it's really hard to make an accurate model so that you can forecast out and project when you're going to need peak capacity.
Thank you very much. The next up is Tegan Wendland for WWNO.
Hi, I'm in New Orleans, and my state health department is telling me, as you know, in Louisiana, that it's too hard to get this data right now. So, you know, why do we need access to this data right now? Why is that so important? And do we have any legal recourse?
This is Kristen Clark. In terms of legal recourse, we intend to use Title VI of the Civil Rights Act and Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act as our weapons here to fight. This is a life and death. These are life and death matters that we're up against. We believe that our federally funded healthcare providers need to do their part and comply with the law and make racial and ethnic demographic data available to ensure that we are not discriminating in the way that we are fighting this pandemic, to ensure equitable access to testing, equitable access to care, and to make sure that we understand and provide the transparency that the public deserves during this pandemic.
Yeah, it seems like it's not too much to ask for the fatalities, especially. Researchers are pointing out to me that that's right on the death certificate, so I don't understand why that's so hard for them to provide to me.
We agree with you.
Thank you.
Next up is Nancy Anururu. My apologies for the pronunciation of ABC News.
Hi. So my question was, you know, I think we've talked a lot about what health departments can do at the state level and local level, but what about frontline physicians and other first responders? Is there anything that you would recommend that can be done at that stage of when patients are presenting that can potentially help mitigate some of the disparities that we're seeing?
Sure, I can answer that question. I think that physicians and other healthcare workers in particular have a vested interest in knowing this information too, because it helps them ultimately figure out how to keep themselves safe. Again, if you know the amount of cases that are going to happen in your area and your surge, and you can get the resource that you need, or at least try to request them for that. I think if you're a physician on the front line, you need to be an advocate for testing. And a lot of times when there's an equivocal situation or a chance where you can advocate and say, I really need this patient to get a test, and it may not be indicated because of some restrictive rules, it's the job of the physician, in my opinion, to break through that. There were several times early on in, when Virginia was rolling out testing, we had a low case number. We had a very restrictive, because our tests were limited, we had a restrictive set of rules as to who could be tested or not. So if you had someone that did not meet those strict criteria, and you still want to get them tested, you have to jump through that hoop. I think it's the obligation of healthcare workers to try to advocate to get testing done, and if those resources aren't there, to advocate for them. So instead of just saying, you know, we're going to accept that, we said, what can we do to set up our own in-house testing so that we don't have to depend on rules from agencies that we don't think are appropriate or broad enough to really get a good sense and protect our community? We basically didn't take no for an answer. We said we can come up with a better solution in-house. And when those barriers came up, we broke through those as well, too. So when we needed machines to run the PCR, that's the kind of test that's done to actually extract from the samples to see if there's COVID RNA in there, we didn't have machines that were FDA cleared. So we got special approval. And we got those machines from our basic science labs, and that's what we used to initially set our testing up. So at least every step of the way, there was some barrier or someone we needed to break through or someone we needed to talk to. We were willing to take that step and talk with that person and go outside the usual chain of command to make things happen. And I think, as providers on the front line, we're vested, we have the ability to advocate. A lot of times we don't realize the voice and power that we have, but we really do. So I would say to physicians and nurses, especially ones that, you know, our lives are at risk here as well, we need to be those advocates and live up to the expectations of our patients.
Yeah, I'd like to add to
I'd like to add to that as well. I think, you know, a lot of these issues that we're discussing today in terms of testing and recording cases are structural issues. And I think healthcare workers, need to realize that, you know, we can actually reinforce those structural issues or those structural inequities. And I think some of the issues that are coming up are some that Tyson talked about in terms of, you know, having to ration testing. And, you know, I know also he's probably experiencing having to ration who gets, you know, ventilators. And so these are issues where some of those structural inequities can become perpetuated and reinforced. And so that's why this is an issue that, you know, as Tyson mentioned, that healthcare workers also need to be aware of so that we're ensuring that, you know, all patients are receiving equitable care.
Thank you.
And once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touchtone phone.
Next up is going to be Stephen Johnson from the New York Amsterdam News.
Good afternoon. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, great, great. So this is in particular for the folks who are in New York. New York State's broken down the infection numbers by county, by borough, by zip code. Now, it could be easily deduced based on zip code the disproportionate people who are affected. Why do you think they're not taking that extra step, considering we know what neighborhoods reside in what zip codes?
Anyone?
This is Kristen Clark.
Go ahead, Ms. Clark.
This is Kristen Clark. It's hard to understand intent. What we do know is that we face a grave crisis, and everything that we have seen, including reports from health professionals on the front lines of this fight and the data that has emerged from pockets of the country, all make clear that this crisis is having a starker impact on African Americans. We hope that officials will find the political will to do their part and to bring transparency to the crisis, to shine a light on all of the ways in which the crisis is impacting communities. We have seen data along lines of geography and gender. We've seen it broken down by day, and it's critical that officials right now take the next step and shine a light on the racial impact that COVID-19 is having across the country. Dr. Bell?
Sure. The only thing I was going to say is that it just needs to happen. And so, you know, while we're asking the question, you know, what is the intent and why aren't they releasing it, that's the time to send an email or make a phone call to demand accountability. In my mind, this does not seem like a hard decision to make. And maybe I'm missing something here, but a virus that can rapidly spread through a community, communities of color and disadvantaged populations, it seemed to show from what we've seen that they're at a disadvantage. And then that virus can then spread to other populations and throughout the world, as we've seen. This started in the animal market in China, and look at what's happened now. It doesn't seem like a hard decision to me to say we need to get the data out there so that we can fully understand the problem and we can put out our hotspots and understand what's going on, because ultimately that's going to impact the health of the entire country and the entire world. I don't understand why it's been so difficult, but again, that's to explore later. We just need to get that data out there and demand it. That's why I'm happy I'm on this call today.
I agree, and I feel like, you know, the same structural issues that have resulted in profound healthcare disparities among, you know, different racial populations, is probably the same reason why we're asking why this data is not being disclosed. But the fact is, and I think many of us on the front lines have seen this in the last few weeks, and we have the preliminary data, is that we are we're in a crisis right now. People are dying and it's only going to get worse. And so we need to demand accountability that this demographic data is released as soon as possible.
Next up is Camila Newton from Yahoo Lifestyle. Camila.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. I think that my initial question was asked and answered, but what has come up in my mind is I understand that the law obviously prohibits them from discriminating, but I would like to know if, you know, state officials have the do they have the ability to just refuse to release that data? I know that they're obligated to collect it, but are they obligated to release it, and would they be within their legal, you know, limits if they just said that, you know, like, we declined to release that to the public, or could, like, they be forced?
This is Kristen Clark. Sadly, we are seeing refusal now. At the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, we are prepared to use every tool in our arsenal to press officials to begin disclosing this data with all deliberate speed.
And this is Darielle Rodriguez, Director of the Economic Justice Project at the Lawyers Committee. So today we issued both a letter to HHS asking them to release the data for CDC and its sub-agencies. We also issued a FOIA request to the CDC because, as we discussed earlier, we know that they have issued a form for health departments to fill out that is soliciting this information. So at the state level, we've issued letters. We have not issued a FOIA request. But we took this multi-pronged approach because it is public data, and pursuant to a FOIA, they should be releasing it.
Thanks.
Next up is Karen Buford from the Detroit News.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my question. I actually have two questions. My first is there any evidence at this time that communities of color have received less testing than other communities? And my second question is with regard to the use of hydroxychloroquine and other anti-malarial drugs. Is there any way to track who is receiving those drugs and whether there are any disparities in terms of who's getting treated with hydroxychloroquine and those other medicines?
Sure, this is Tyson. I can answer some of your questions. I pointed earlier to data released by Michigan, a detail that cases were made up 35% African American despite 14% of the population. I'm not aware, because I haven't been looking specifically for this, about testing discrepancies, but we do have data that we've obtained from a company called Rubix LS that we've been collaborating with, who has a smartphone app that collects patients who are reporting influenza-like symptoms and then ultimately reporting what their outcome was. So it links with the healthcare provider network that validates their symptoms, and then they can show us what sort of outcome they had, whether they got testing that was performed or something was prescribed to them. I do want to, just because I want to get this message out about hydroxychloroquine, that access to drugs is very, very important, but it's also important that we prescribe drugs in a safe manner and medicines that have been approved and have been closely studied. And hydroxychloroquine, though it may have some efficacy against COVID disease, it also may not have efficacy, and we have not conducted the studies to actually sort out the toxicity versus the safety profile and how well it works. Hydroxychloroquine can cause the heart to stop, so it can literally kill people. Luckily, that's a very small percentage of patients, but we need to conduct a randomized trial to actually compare that fatal side effect and other side effects, as well as the efficacy of the actual drug, so we can understand how well it actually works. So I know that wasn't a topic of this talk, but I also wanted to make sure that the message was out there from physicians that we do need to be careful about the drugs that we recommend. And unfortunately, politics, when it gets involved in the scientific process, is a really unfortunate thing.
I'm aware that in Detroit, many of the hospitals are actually using hydroxychloroquine. And what I'm wondering about is if there's any mechanism to not only track the efficacy of it and the safety of it, but whether or not it's being, you know, there's any degree of equity in how it's being used.
Sure. I mean, we know that we have vast discrepancies and disparities in healthcare prescribing. One of my good friends, Atube Essien, who practices at University of Pittsburgh, he studied this in great detail, and he's shown lots of data that there's differential prescribing practices in many different healthcare settings for cardiac drugs and et cetera, hypertension drugs and things like that. I would not be surprised if there were discrepancies in prescribing practices for hydroxychloroquine or any other drug that would treat COVID. I just haven't specifically looked into that, but I can ask him for you.
Thank you.
I did want to make a note about the testing. So even when the CDC first disseminated testing criteria, it required exposure to someone who had been tested previously or traveled to one of the pandemic areas. And I saw that in the community where I practice in Central Brooklyn, which is mostly Black and brown, low income, that for a few weeks, we were only testing certain patients who were actually more likely to be white and more likely to be affluent. And what we know now is that COVID-19 had been circulating in our communities for much longer than we realized, and that there were many patients who had not been actually tested based on the criteria. Now, since then, our testing guidelines have evolved. But just in thinking about how sometimes testing criteria can actually also be embedded with bias, which is why we need to know those numbers about who is being tested and who's not being tested.
Thank you.
Thank you again for all of your patience, everybody who's waiting on the line. I'm just going to call out who the next three journalists are going to be. The first up is going to be Rebecca Rivas for the St. Louis American. After her will be Talia Buford from ProPublica, and after Talia will be Michael Gartland from Daily News. Thank you again for your patience, and our call is going to be recorded. We're also going to be going a little bit over an hour, just so that you know. Rebecca.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my question. My question was regarding requirements that for reporting. One of the things that we were seeing in St. Louis was that the medical institutions were required by executive order by our local officials to report the positive cases, but they weren't requiring the negative cases, and so we had no idea how many people were being tested or where. Is there any effort to include, like in some kind of executive order on local levels, to have them require the reporting of this demographic data? Because in our state, in St. Louis, you know, we're a Democratic city, but we're in a Republican state, and so we barely just got a stay-at-home order statewide this weekend, but we've been under local state order or a stay-at-home order for a couple weeks now. So is there anything that local officials can do to require this reporting, and is that something that you're supporting or advocating for?
Yeah, this is Kristen Clark. We've certainly seen governors use their executive powers in broad ways to ensure public safety, including the issuance of stay-at-home orders all across the country. It would certainly seem to be within the realm of gubernatorial power across the country to order that their own state public health agencies do their part to make racial and ethnic demographic data available.
Can I ask one more question? One thing that I saw in St. Louis was the federally qualified health centers. They explained that they were ready to become emergency responders, and they volunteered to be testing sites early on when the first cases came out in St. Louis, but they only were given actually like 5 tests per location, and these were all areas that were located in a majority African-American, and here it was 90% African-American or higher. And so there was a lag in testing. I think it's now 4 weeks. They're finally getting about 2,500 tests with the federally qualified health centers, and we already have more than 600 cases. Do you think that that is one of the reasons why there is more spread in some of these minority communities was because the FQHCs were not being allowed to test, places where they would be able to get testing for free rather than going to the hospital where they would have to pay hospital prices?
Our doctors?
I'm not sure about the answer to that question.
Yeah, I can also say I'm not sure to answer that question. We do know that testing was severely limited early on, and that's another failure that definitely needs to be addressed. The thing I would point out is that there are some creative solutions that even if you can't get a direct COVID test, you could get a sense of what was going on in the community absent of COVID testing. So, for instance, COVID causes a very clinical picture that's similar to influenza. So if you're tracking your influenza reporting data, and the CDC does track this along with other public health agencies, you could see if there's an increase in your influenza activity outside of the pattern that you would normally expect, and you could deduce that some of these are from COVID activities. That's a way that you could look at it and maybe not get direct data, but you have at least some instance of what's going on. You could even test those patients for influenza to see how many of them actually do have influenza, and if you don't have to test for COVID, then you could say, well, there's a higher likelihood that you may have COVID disease, and we would manage the patient the exact same way as if they had tested positive. So even if the testing is limited and you're trying to set it up or get more testing ability and capacity, there are still other ways that you can assess what's going on in the community without having a direct COVID test. And I apologize, but I have to go to my COVID clinic shift. But thank you all for having me on the call. I'm very glad that we got together, and please just get access and reporting on testing. Thank you all.
Thank you for joining us, Dr. Bell.
So in the interest of time, I'm going to ask 3 reporters to ask their questions. The first is going to be Talia Buford. If you could just ask your question, and then I'm going to ask 2 more reporters to ask their questions, and then let those be a joint answer. Talia?
Okay. This is Talia Buford from ProPublica. I am wondering, I know that you said that you're interested in possibly using Title VI of the Civil Rights Act to kind of compel state or even federal health agencies to release race data. I'm wondering, has Title VI been an effective tool for HHS? I know that in some other agencies, like the EPA, for example, those challenges often take years to process. And I'm wondering, has HHS been more responsive to Title VI challenges in the past?
Okay, the next person to ask the question is going to be Michael Garland.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hey, a couple of questions. One, have you filed any legal documents in any jurisdictions as far as the Title VI and the ACA rules you talked about, Kristen? And if so, what jurisdictions did you file those in? Also, have you guys reached out to either the law departments or departments of health in New York City and state? And if so, what kind of explanation have they given you as far as why this demographic data has taken so long? I mean, we still don't have it. They say they're working on it, but it's been quite a while now. Thank you.
So this is
These are very two very distinct questions, so let's just stick with those first two. Kristen.
Yes, this is Kristen Clark, Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. For now, we're focused on our demand letter to the Department of Health and Human Services, and we're also issuing Freedom of Information Act letters to obtain information and data, and on a separate path, also issuing letters to states, to state health departments in particular. We are hopeful that we will get a response. This is a crisis like none other, and we believe that officials across our federal and state governments stand to play an important role here and bringing needed transparency to the crisis so that we can understand the communities that are impacted and the communities that are facing a disproportionate and starker impact will be critical to efforts to beat back this pandemic. Our hope is that we will secure voluntary compliance and a response from these agencies, but we're prepared to use every tool in our arsenal as we move forward. We need data, and we believe that if officials have the political will, that we can, we should be able to start seeing data made publicly available today.
Hello, are you there?
Yes.
Yeah, and it's for the second question. Have you spoken to anybody at the law department or the Department of Health in New York City or New York State in particular? And if so, what have they? What kind of response have they given you as far as an explanation of why this is taking so long?
Yeah, we're happy to follow up with you offline to talk about state level responses as we move forward. So we'll take your information and be in touch.
Talia, did you get the response you needed? Talia Buford?
I was wondering if you guys had seen in the past HHS being responsive to Title VI challenges and that wasn't addressed. I understand that you're going to use other methods, but I'm wondering if in the past you've seen Title VI be an effective method for getting results from HHS specifically.
Kristen?
Sorry. So the federal government also plays an important role here. The Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department also has enforcement powers under Title VI. Civil rights organizations have had some degree of success in using Title VI as a tool to seek compliance from federally funded entities across the country. But again, we are hopeful that given the gravity of the crisis, that we'll achieve voluntary compliance.
Next up is Bridget Bergen from WNYC.
Hi, thanks so much for doing this call and for spending this much time and for your assistance with technical challenges. Specifically, you know, I posed this question to New York City Mayor de Blasio and our health commissioner yesterday about why this data was not being released. And part of the answer that our health commissioner gave was that they could only report accurate and consistent data if they get good data in. And I know you said that the CDC form requires them to collect that data, but part of what she was saying is that they're getting incomplete data from laboratories and their healthcare delivery partners.
And so two questions. One, you know, for the doctor from Brooklyn, do you, what is your response to that explanation? And then more generally, do you have concerns about data being published that isn't accurate?
So I'm having some technical difficulties. I think I heard most of your question. So I will say that, and while I am aware that we do have some data that, and it may be incomplete for New York City, that we definitely need, because of the gravity of the situation, as Kristen Clark mentioned, that we need to get whatever data we have out there. I believe we probably do have enough to show some very concerning trends. And what was the second part of your question?
Excuse me. Are you concerned that if they do put out data that is incomplete, that there is a risk associated with that, a misinterpretation of data because they're not collecting complete data?
Well, you know, I think that the situation is quickly evolving, and I think that, you know, probably data is changing from week to week. I think the data that we already have now that was published in New York Times last week shows the highest positive cases of COVID-19 in mostly low-income areas of the city, which are mostly black and brown. So I think we already have a lot of very important data that we can start to act on, and that shouldn't really prevent us from releasing the full data when that time comes.
Anything else? In the interest of time, I know that there are several reporters who have been waiting extremely patiently on this call. Please email your questions to press@lawyerscommittee.org. Again, that's press@lawyerscommittee.org. That's also for any other people who have been waiting to ask a question that have not yet joined into the queue. Again, mail it to press@lawyerscommittee.org if you want it directed in general or if you want it directed to a specific person. And again, the speakers on the call were Kristen Clark, President and Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, Dr. Uche Blackstock, Founder and CEO of Advancing Health Equity, Dr. Tyson Bell, Associate Assistant Professor of Medicine, and Darielle Rodriguez. I'm going to turn the call back to Kristen Clark for a final wrap-up, and she may turn it over to Darielle Rodriguez for a few more details.
We'll break here and let Dr. Blackstock, we know that Dr. Bell has already left, return to the front lines of this fight. We thank them for their service and their work. And at the conclusion of this call, we'll be issuing a press release that outlines the action that we're taking today, including the letter that we're directing to the head of the Department of Health and Human Services, a series of Freedom of Information Act requests that we are issuing, and demand letters that we're sending to state public health departments across the country. Our goal is bringing desperately needed transparency to the racial and demographic impact of COVID-19. And we are calling for racial and demographic data to be made publicly available with all deliberate speed to help inform an equitable response to the crisis. So we thank all of our participants and reporters for joining us today. And again, you can contact the Lawyers Committee at press@lawyerscommittee.org with follow-up questions and inquiries. Thank you for joining us.